Case number 20-3028 et al. United States of America versus Nizar Trabelsi, also known as Nizar Ben Abdelaziz Trabelsi, also known as Abu Kaka Appellant. Ms. Getzel for the appellant, Mr. Smith for the appellee.
Good morning, Ms. Getzel. We'll hear from you.
Good morning, Judge Wilkins. May it please the court. Celia Getzel for appellant Nizar Trabelsi, and I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. Since the court heard this case in 2017, U.S. authorities have ignored the Kingdom of Belgium's official united, uncontested position as relayed through its Ministry of Justice that one, counts one and two of the U.S. indictment may violate Article 5 of the treaty, and two, regardless, under the terms of this bilateral treaty, under uncontested Belgian law, and under Belgium's grant of extradition, specifically in this case, Mr. Trabelsi cannot be prosecuted for overt acts 23 through 26, specifically the conspiracy to bomb the Kleinbrugel base. U.S. prosecutors have portrayed for the lower courts and for this court, a foreign separation of powers issue that simply does not exist in Belgium, and somehow convinced the lower courts to ignore Belgium's official interpretation of a bilateral treaty, completely disregard the ministry's official acts recognizing the supremacy of its judiciary.
Ms. Getzel, can you be clear about the separation of powers issue? What are you saying that the U.S. is ignoring? What is the separation of powers question that you're identifying?
So the U.S. has suggested that there is some sort of separation of powers issue in Belgium that the lower court should ignore, and that the U.S. courts should ignore. But what we're saying is there is no separation of powers issue. There is one united voice there.
And by separation of powers, I guess I'm just asking, you're saying the purported difference between the court's view and the ministry's view. Is that what you mean by separation of powers?
That's correct. The U.S. Government in this case has portrayed that the minister's view of the actual grant of extradition in this case is somehow different from the court's view of that grant of extradition, and that is simply not the case here.
Suppose we don't agree with you, and we believe that the ministry does take a different view than the courts. Why shouldn't we view that the ministry's view, the executive's view, prevails?
The ministry has relayed the supremacy of the judiciary. So the ministry has adopted the judiciary's view in complying with the orders of—
You're fighting my hypothetical. My hypothetical is, suppose we disagree with that argument and we find that the ministry is basically conveying what the court told it to convey, but not necessarily what it believes the proper interpretation of the treaty is. What do we do then?
So two things. One, that is the interpretation of the treaty is separate from what the grant of extradition in this case permitted. So adherence to the exequitur of the arrest warrant. And the ministry has never said that the exequitur wasn't part of the grant of extradition in this case. Secondly, this court, sister court, has spoken directly to it and said the District Court of Appeal for the District of Columbia interprets the ministerial order as authorizing extradition without the limits set during the exequitur of the arrest warrant. It doesn't say the ministry has interpreted its ministerial order as authorizing extradition without the limits set. It says that this court has misinterpreted and made a mistake about what it is that was actually granted when.
Ms. Getzel, how do you square that position with the Brussels Court of Appeals ruling in the context of the motion to enforce, in which it appears, and I'm looking at 2021, I believe, JA 2021, when it appears to recognize what this court has said and that there is some sort of distinction or conflict between what the court views and what the ministerial order says. I mean, it suggests very clearly that the DC Circuit has given priority to the ministerial order, and that its own decisions don't modify or cancel that order. So I'm not sure that I understand your view that there is a unified voice coming from Belgium as to what is happening here.
So first of all, I think that this citation on 2021, the court is referring to Judge Moss's lower court decision here, not the DC Circuit's decision.
Except it says the DC Circuit in the very first sentence of the paragraph. The aforementioned American decisions, and in particular that of the DC Circuit, currently before appeal, right?
Yes. So what this is saying is that the courts recognize that there's a dissension, there's a difference in interpretation of how Article 5 of the treaty should be applied. So to the extent that there's a difference in decision of how the law is applied, that has been finally decided. That was finally decided in Belgium when the appeal was the government's appeal of the August 2019 decision was dismissed. So as a legal matter, if the court here is looking to what is Belgian law, then it should look to the courts as to how to interpret Belgian law. If the court is looking to how to interpret the extradition treaty, the ministry has relayed through a March 5th note a very clear prescription that Mr. Trabelsi cannot be tried here for overt acts 23 through 26, and that the court should familiarize itself with the analysis in Belgium and at least consider that that is the law in Belgium.
Ms. Getzel, can I just ask you, you mentioned the dismissal of this decision, or where is that? Is that somewhere in the record?
So that is cited in a footnote in our briefs, and the government has recognized it as well. It's the Court of Cassation decision. It's the last decision in the appendix at page 2200. And that occurred on March 4th of 2021.
And are we just taking judicial notice of that, or is it somewhere in the record?
Yes, the court, it is in the appendix. We've cited it. It is a decision of a foreign court that the court can take judicial notice of. It actually found no legal basis for the government's appeal of the August 8th decision.
Ms. Getzel, if I could just ask you some questions about subject matter jurisdiction here for the court. Our court in 2017 didn't reach the question of remedies, what would be the appropriate remedy if you were to prevail. But I'm wondering if there were a violation of the treaty here, what the remedy would be. And it seems to me that the remedy in part may go to the question of subject matter jurisdiction, because it's unclear to me. I mean, if we can't dismiss the indictment, then how does Mr. Trabelsi have redressability for his claims? So I'm wondering if you could address that question.
So I'm a little unclear on your question in terms of a remedy, we are asking the court at a minimum to order that overt acts 23 through 26 be stricken from the indictment to give effect to the extradition order in this case, so that he is not tried for crimes that he was already tried for in violation of the treaty. The court can dismiss the indictment and can discharge Mr. Trabelsi under the Supreme Court case law about speciality in Thompson versus Brown.
Isn't speciality a different type of concept? So even under the text of this particular treaty, the prior prosecution limit in Article 5 seems to run to the extraditing state, to Belgium, right? Belgium has an obligation not to extradite someone in violation of Article 5. So once Mr. Trabelsi is extradited and he's now here in the United States, does he have an injury or a claim against the US government for a violation of Article 5? I mean, it doesn't seem that the United States is the cause of his harm in this instance, right? It's the Belgian government who has the treaty obligation. Whereas for speciality, the US government has an obligation, and those claims may well be cognizable. But it's not clear to me that he has a prior prosecution claim against the US government or a non-bis claim against the US government once he's already been extradited by Belgium.
So he does, because Article 5, both parties have contracted, and Article 5 applies to both parties, and the harm here that must be redressed and the reason why this is here pre-trial is because the harm is in him being tried for offenses for which he has already been tried. So this court can stop that harm, redress that harm, and stop the violation of Article 5, the violation of putting him in jeopardy twice for the same things that he was already tried for in Belgium by stopping this prosecution.
Ms. Getzel, can you cite, are there any cases in US courts in which such a claim has been successful? So where someone has already been extradited and there's a claim that they should not have been extradited under, a non-bis or prior prosecution type of treaty obligation? Because I was not able to find any such case, and I don't believe that Mr. Trabelsi cites any of those cases in his briefing. It seems that the nature of non-bis is that it runs against the extraditing state. And there are a number of cases that suggest that is how that principle is understood.
It runs for both countries in the treaty, as written in the treaty. So extradition shall not be granted when the person sought has been found guilty, convicted, or acquitted in the requested state for the offense for which extradition is
granted. Sure, both countries have an obligation not to extradite people in violation of this principle. So if someone were in the United States and Belgium was seeking extradition to Belgium, the United States would have an obligation not to violate Article 5, and a person about to be extradited perhaps would have the ability to challenge their extradition under Article 5 before they were extradited. But it seems that this language, I think, pretty clearly runs against the extraditing, the state that's been requested to extradite. Extradition shall not be granted.
Here, the state that extradited Mr. Trabelsi is telling US authorities, whoops, like maybe we shouldn't have extradited him.
Well, I want to follow up on that point, which is a sort of an extension of what Judge Rao just mentioned, which is, why is it then that we should now care about or give effect to a change? So assuming that at the time the order was originally issued, it was clear and there was dissension between the Ministry of Justice and the courts regarding whether or not this person should be extradited. We get the order, the person is extradited. Under what circumstance can the ministry then change its mind about the extradition and have us give that effect in terms of striking the provisions or whatnot, the remedy that you want us to apply? Why should we do that? I mean, in general, we believe in finality of rulings, that new law doesn't necessarily redound to the benefit of a person who was previously considered under it. So I'm just not sure why it matters that they've now changed their mind, according to you.
So the ministry, our position is not that the ministry has changed its mind. It hasn't changed its mind. Our position is that, and it's pretty ambiguous, the extradition order is ambiguous. Belgium clearly thought, and that's apparent from this new decision, that it was limiting the grant of extradition to exclude these acts that he had already been tried for in Belgium. And the extradition order was somewhat ambiguous. It said that he was being extradited pursuant to the exequatur, pursuant.
Okay, can I ask you, if the order is ambiguous, I'm not sure it necessarily means that we ask the court for the answer, right? I mean, you can imagine a world in which because this is a political process, I think you would concede that. There seemed like there could be a number of options for construing an ambiguous extradition order, one of which is we turn to the diplomats and we say, can you please go ask the ministry what this means, since it isn't clear? One, I think, could be figuring out what Belgian courts actually do in terms of their construction of ambiguous law. So if we were to, you know, apply Belgian law, like what is their rule of construction when they confront ambiguous text? Or we could apply our own rules of construction as to how we address, which I think is somewhat what Judge Moss did in this case. We look at the text, is it clear or whatnot, right? So why are you suggesting we do get a fourth option, which is just ask the Belgian courts how they would interpret this particular provision?
So we're not saying that the treaty provision is ambiguous. We're saying that the extradition order, the fact of the grant of extradition, so the 2011 ministerial order, may have been, and maybe it might have even been purposefully ambiguous, but now we have a final interpretation of what that, of the scope of the grant of extradition under the ministerial order.
And that's coming from the courts or from the ministry?
It is coming from both. I mean, the March 5th note and all of the Belgian state's pleadings in Belgium make clear that its judiciary is supreme, that it might have taken a different position in litigation, which, you know, happens here all the time when the DOJ takes a different position in litigation.
What about the position it took in the actual diplomatic notes that it sent when it was clarifying what the order meant? That's not in litigation. It sent a note, didn't it? The ministry.
The note that it sent in 2019, in November of 2019, it has explained in official statements, was simply meant to convey that it had appealed the interpretation of article, that it had appealed the August 2019 decision and differs in its interpretation of whether an offense-based or fact-based analysis should apply to Article 5 of the treaty. But that's not what we're saying here. The minister never questioned that the grant of the court's final determination that the grant of extradition does not allow Mr. Trabelsi to be prosecuted here for overt acts 23 through 26.
Ms. Getzel, did the ministry ever explicitly state that in any communication to the United States, that those overt acts were excluded?
The ministry never explicitly stated that the overt acts were included. So the ministry said that those overt acts could be used as facts or evidence, that can be used as evidence to prove the charges in the United States. But the ministry has been ambiguous. It has never stated that he can be convicted here for the conspiracy to bomb Klein Vogel.
Or that can't.
The problem that I have, though, with all of this is that, you know, we heard this case in 2017. And it seems to me that a procedure whereby once the extradition is granted and the person is sent here, when the communications are made with the stipulations as to what the grounds will be for allowing the extradition, but that should be the end of it. We're 4 years later, and here we are trying to, you know, discern what these Belgian court decisions really mean, and whether there's a real dispute between the executive and the judiciary about what they meant with the extradition order. I mean, why should we, at this point, why should we really do anything other than just follow the law of the case doctrine and say, this has been decided?
I mean, it's truly extraordinary that your sister court, the Brussels Court of Appeals, has said to you, you misinterpreted the grant of extradition. You made a mistake the first time. That is significant and material cause to reopen the decision. But also, there is no dispute in Belgium that he cannot be convicted here, that at a minimum, overt acts 23 through 26 were excluded because the ministry never disavowed the exequatur. The order of enforcement in extraditing Mr. Trabelsi, and the law also in Belgium is finally decided. Like, it is clear under Belgian law that Article 5 requires a fact-based analysis. It's 100% clear. There is no other interpretation that can be made. The minister has relayed the court's final decision. So to the extent that this court did not recognize that or fully consider the final law in Belgium when considering what deference it was giving to the Belgian extradition decision and to and in basically not engaging in an analysis of what Article 5 means, in deferring to what it thought was a reasonable interpretation, what the Belgian government has now told you is that that was not Belgian law. That was not a reasonable interpretation of the treaty under Belgian law. So,
Ms. Getzel, if I could ask you a related question, do you think that the Trabelsi decision in 2017 of this court, do you think that its jurisdictional holding is law of the case for us?
Yes.
Deciding this appeal?
Yes, there's been no question of jurisdiction in this case. Neither party has raised it, so it hasn't. And it hasn't been.
Well, but jurisdiction is something we always have to consider to ensure that we have the authority to decide a case. But do you think that the previous panel's decision about jurisdiction is law of the case? I understand you don't think that the merits are law of the case, but do you think the jurisdictional holding is law of the case?
So we don't, first of all, we think the merits and the jurisdiction are law of the case in the sense that the court said we defer to Belgium. There's a presumption that the extradition order was proper. Unless there's some reason to rebut or think that it wasn't, here we have rebutted that presumption. So we're not challenging the law of the case. We are presenting facts that should alter the court's application of that law to the facts of this case. And in terms of jurisdiction, I mean, this is a double jeopardy issue. Mr. Trabelsi is here being tried for the same crimes that he was tried for in Belgium. The harm is the trial. We are pre-trial. And so jurisdiction is proper. And if the court has no further questions.
All right, we'll hear from any further questions?
Yeah, thank you.
All right, we'll hear from the government. We'll give you a couple minutes on rebuttal.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. May it please the court, Peter Smith on behalf of the United States. This court already rejected appellant's challenge to his extradition, and there is no basis for upsetting the court's 2017 decision in this case. Appellant has a very high burden to meet under the law of the case doctrine. As appellant's counsel seemed to recognize today, he has to show extraordinary circumstances. One example would be whether this court's opinion in 2017 were clearly erroneous, which it is not. This court held in 2017 that the extradition order itself was clear and that it clearly allowed appellant to be prosecuted on the US charges without limitation. The courts in Belgium have not withdrawn, retracted, or modified that order of extradition in any way. The treaty is unchanged. The offenses are unchanged. The diplomatic notes sent by the government of Belgium to the United States expressing the view that appellant could be tried on all of the United States charges have not been withdrawn or modified in any way. Appellant's argument basically hinges on pleadings internal to Belgium, which were never directed to the United States, and two notes from Belgium prosecutors conveying Belgian court decisions. Neither.
Can you speak to the exchange that Ms. Getzel and Judge Rao had about the nose bis principle running against the extraditing state? What is the government's, the United States government's view of extradition and the extent to which any potential mistakes about the extraditability, if that's a word, of the individual is something that can be remedied by this court?
Your Honor, as the government pointed out, there are principles of comedy in its brief. The principles of comedy would be that this court would not second guess or look behind the extradition decision or the grant of extradition to see whether Belgium violated its own laws, for example, or whether Belgium properly applied its laws.
Well, what if assume in a hypothetical that the ministry and the courts now come running, the Belgian ministry, the Belgian courts, they've extradited this person with the order that we have, and we receive a diplomatic note signed by the minister and the head of the judicial officer that says we were wrong, so sorry. We don't think this person can be either extradited or that these charges can go forward. Is that something that, how do we account for that, or could we account for that?
That would certainly be a harder case than the facts of this case. And one could take the position that there would be no change, meaning that once extradited, the Belgian government couldn't somehow undo its extradition. But in the hypothetical, I understand the Belgian executive branch, the Ministry of Justice, to be saying, you know, there was some error, there was some infirmity in the extradition, which I guess would make it a harder case. The government hasn't argued that.
Would it make it a non-justiciable case? Judge Rao suggests that at that point, there's no remedy. If extradition is done and it's over, there's no redressability.
I think there is support for that view. The government didn't expressly argue that in its pleadings in this case. The government seemed to think that appellant would have some sort of recourse under the treaty, but he isn't entitled to dismissal of the indictment, and he, you know, the court's question is a hypothetical. It is not this case. What happened in this case is not that the executive branch has somehow tried to undo the extradition.
So, Mr. Smith, in the facts of this case, if dismissal is not a remedy, how are his claims redressable? You know, is there any redressability for Mr. Trabelsi?
I mean, one could take a strong position and say that under Casey and those sorts of authority that he doesn't, and the government didn't argue that in that way.
I understand the government didn't argue it, but, you know, we do have an independent obligation to determine our jurisdiction. So
I guess I had always assumed that the court would in applying the bilateral treaty, which is also the law of the United States, the treaty itself, that in applying the law, the treaty, that it would be able to reach the question of whether some acts were excluded, but that we didn't brief it that way. We didn't argue it that way. So I'm just sort of speaking off the top of my head.
I think
to answer Judge Rao's question, the government, if this were just a U.S. prosecution that didn't have anything to do with extradition, and the government filed the same indictment, and the district court judge said, I'm going to strike overt acts, 23 through 26, because I don't believe that they are part of the same conspiracy. So I'm going to strike those acts from the indictment. Under 3731, you could appeal that, and we'd have jurisdiction over that interlocutory appeal, wouldn't we?
Yes, that would be right. I think so.
And then is that essentially what the same as what Trabelsi is saying here, or the relief that he is asking for here?
I mean, you're saying by analogy that if it were a U.S. case, right, he'd be able to obtain that relief. And I think we've always understood that to be the case. That's the way we brief this case so far, that any relief he could get could be limited to striking those acts, but he can't get dismissal of the indictment. I think that was our position in our briefs.
But
not because it's not a remedy that you're saying, because he's not entitled to it under these circumstances, not because that's not something the court doesn't have the power to order.
I think that's right. Although I think we also argued that dismissal of the indictment wasn't a remedy the court could grant for the harm he was alleging, which is a violation of the treaty in this particular way.
But I mean, the government can take an interlocutory appeal under very limited circumstances, but one of them is if evidence is excluded. So if there's a criminal trial and the district court judge says, I'm not going to allow introduction of evidence concerning X, if it's important enough to the government and they believe that it's going to place their ability to obtain a conviction in jeopardy, it can take an interlocutory appeal of that ruling excluding evidence, and we have jurisdiction to hear that, right?
You would. And I guess where this case differs is that appellant's rights here are limited to the bilateral treaty between the United States and Belgium. And although it's akin to a double jeopardy claim, it's not a double jeopardy claim under the US Constitution. It's a treaty-based claim, and the Belgian government is a separate sovereign. So there's no real double jeopardy bar. The relief that appellant could obtain runs solely from the treaty.
Which is sad. So, I mean, I agree with Judge Wilkins that, an interlocutory appeal here, we may well have jurisdiction for that. But the question is whether Mr. Trabelsi has an injury that's cognizable under the treaty. As you say, the only basis for his claim at this point is his treaty rights. And I'm not sure how Article 5 runs against the U.S. government. It may run against the Belgian government as the extraditing state, but I'm not sure how Article 5 runs against the U.S. government, and I'm not sure how the U.S. government would have caused his harm under Article 5, which he claims is, you know, being unlawfully extradited by Belgium. So perhaps you could speak to that.
Yeah, I mean, I take the court's point, and it's certainly a reasonable position. And I understand the court's focus on the granting of extradition on the requested state, which is Belgium. But I was simply saying the government didn't make that argument in its briefs.
Mr. Smith, isn't the answer that to the extent that an extradition occurs pursuant to certain conditions that are noted by the requested state, they say we're allowing this extradition, but in many cases, not in toto, right? You can't execute him, for example, I think was one of the conditions in this very case, right? So that to the extent then that the receiving state violates that condition, I'm wondering whether the person isn't injured and has a cognizable injury, as Judge Rao points out, under the treaty, insofar as the extradition order, which was issued under the treaty, has specific conditions that the receiving state is violating. So if we had, for example, in this case, a very clear extradition order that says you cannot prosecute him for offenses 23, 24 through 26, or whatever it is, and that everybody was in agreement, the minister spelled it out very clearly, and the United States proceeded to do so, I don't know whether we would say that is not a cognizable injury from the point of the United States for a person trying to get, bring a claim in this court. They could say under the treaty, these are the conditions, they're being violated. They run to the original state. However, you are a party to that treaty and you agreed upon accepting his extradition not to proceed in a certain way. Am I right about that?
Yes, and the short answer to your question, Your Honor, is that that would be a different kind of claim. That would be a specialty claim where the argument would be that the prosecution somehow extended beyond the grant of extradition. Specialty is a doctrine that is not subject to interlocutory appeal, and this is explained in the government's brief. So appellant's interlocutory appeal, which is this appeal, is limited to Article 5 of the treaty, his double jeopardy type claim. So in the court's question or hypothetical where something extend where the US government was somehow not complying with the grant of extradition, that would be a specialty claim. Like, for example, we filed charges and sought appellant's execution in the court's example, or we filed new charges that weren't covered in the extradition order. That those would be specialty claims.
I see, but we would ultimately have jurisdiction if the prosecution occurred and he was what, convicted or not, then he could bring it. It's just a matter of interlocutory versus later. It's not
right. That would never be. That would be part of his direct. Exactly. That would be part of his direct appeal. He could say, you know, hey, they charged me. They said they were charging me with conspiracy, but they also added these five other counts that weren't conspiracy. And so that would be part of his direct appeal following his conviction.
And there are lots of cases adjudicating those types of specialty claims under treaties. Are you aware of any case where someone has successfully brought a prior prosecution or non-bis claim after being extradited to the United States?
I'm not, Your Honor. And the government's brief says expressly that at least framed narrowly in the way that appellant is raising this claim, we were not able to find any such case.
I was not able to find any such case either.
If the court has no further questions, I would urge the court to affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you very much.
All right, I think you were out of time, but we'll give you 2 minutes.
Thank you. There may be no such case because normally countries don't prosecute people for the same thing twice. So double jeopardy has not really been an issue. None of the cases that are referring to speciality claims, they're also sort of entwined with these claims of dual criminality. The exclusion on extradition was specifically grounded in Article 5 of the treaty. It's a double jeopardy claim. The reason that the Kingdom of Belgium granted his extradition, not for everything, allowed him to be extradited here, but excluded over Acts 23 through 26, or because charging him and convicting him and trying him for those overt acts violate Article 5 of the treaty. And so that is the right that Mr. Trabelsi is seeking to vindicate. In addition, I just want to note that, I mean, this is a domestic criminal prosecution, and the right under the treaty is the right not to be tried, the double jeopardy right that both parties to a bilateral treaty have agreed upon is Mr. Trabelsi's. And Supreme Court case law is clear on that under Rauscher, that the right inheres to the person who is a beneficiary of the treaty, and that the treaty is our law. So all we are doing is asking the court, this court, to enforce the grant of extradition and the treaty, and to enforce Mr. Trabelsi's right not to be tried twice for the same thing. We ask the court to, at a minimum, order that overt acts 23 through 26 be stricken from the indictment.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement.